The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Shopping under lock and key may be the new reality as thieves get away with stealing goods over and over again from stores like CVS and Walgreens, the latter chain debuting a new anti-theft store this week where almost everything is locked up. This is amazing. Customers are only allowed to shop for themselves in two of the aisles. The rest of the store, locked up, kiosks. The chain says this new experience is all about technology. They're framing it as very exciting. And Molly, I love the PR team's attempt at spin here, being like, isn't this all fresh and new and exciting? Everything now is not, except for two aisles, is not accessible to customers. I mean, right. You got to give them props for trying, I guess.
Yeah, I guess you don't want to say our stores are a hellhole where nobody can feel safe and where thieves are running rampant, so you have to go with something else. But it is a little bit insulting to say that all of these things, which are clearly being done because of the rampant crime that's hitting downtowns in major cities across America, is something to be happy about. I mean, it is a decreased quality of experience for the shopper. That's what happens when you have a breakdown of law and order in our society, and it's good if we can all acknowledge that.
Yeah, and
welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. He's off with the public appearance campaign, the Celtic Throne tour, all of that very exciting stuff going on in the United States. It's great to be back, though, for me on the show to have an opportunity to spend another hour with all of you. I think it's the first time we've been on for a while, so I wanted to say a big thanks to all of those that wrote in their congratulations for the birth of my little boy Peter. I think that was announced on the show. I keep meaning to take a picture of him reading some very heavy-duty geopolitical book to send to Mr. Flurry. I'll have to hop on that, but he's doing very well. But I wanted to start today by talking about a trip I made to Germany just over a week ago. It kind of contrast with a lot of news stories, including that one that we opened the show with Walgreens just having to redesign their stores. Theft is becoming so rampant in the United States. It was just so clear on that trip that the United States and Germany are going in radically different directions. I mean, there are some commonalities and some common trends in both, but the experience is so different. I've not spent masses of time in Germany. I've kind of been in and out a little bit over the years. I'm trying to think, this might have been my third or fourth time maybe going there. But this trip was a bit of a revelation for me. I was only there for two or three days over the Feast of Pentecost, visiting some of our members there. We had quite a good number getting together in the south of Germany near Lake Constance, or I think it's Bodensee in German, near the Swiss border. But it was a bit of a revelation to me, that trip. As a proud Brit, it's kind of hard to say this, but Germany's actually quite nice. It was a very enjoyable trip, and it was a massive contrast in some of these other countries that I visited. You know, I wrote about going to Canada a few years ago, where I'd not been there for a while. We went to Canada, we were visiting my wife's family, and just being away from that country for a few years, it felt like a massive difference coming back. I think this was kind of on the tail end of COVID as things were starting to wind down there. And I wrote at the time how it kind of felt like coming to a defeated country. You land, all of the flags everywhere are at half-mast, and they had been for months over some kind of woke scandal that they'd got going there. Drugs had been legalized since I had visited. They weren't legal when I'd come back, and they were when I got there. And so now you had cannabis shops on every corner. The streets were just full of druggies. I mean, we were staying in kind of downtown Edmonton. My wife didn't really feel safe going out by herself because there were just, you know, all these druggies all around. And I think you know, when it's Britain, when it's, you know, the country that I see every day, some of that decline is so incremental that you don't really notice it. But you leave for a few years, you come back and you're kind of blown away. And Germany was kind of the opposite. I didn't have anything big, say, to contrast to, you know, as in having a big look at Germany, going away for a few years, coming back again. But instead, the contrast with the news and the headlines out of the UK and the US, and then just kind of looking around at what I was seeing in Germany, was really different. I mean, like we opened with that Walgreens story where they're having to reevaluate how their store works. You're now having shops kind of regressing. You know, it used to be a big deal. Supermarkets came along, at least for the UK. You know, you had these smaller shops where the shopkeeper did your shopping for you. You know, you walked into the greengrocer and you said, I need 5 carrots, 2 cucumbers, I need some pepper. And, you know, he'd go and he'd fetch them for you and hand them to you. And then you get the supermarket where you go and you do your shopping yourself. And this makes goods cheaper because you don't need as much staff, and you can have bigger stores where you can go and do all the shopping in one place because you don't need someone to go and collect it all for you. And now we're kind of reaching the point where, well, we don't have the character to have supermarkets anymore as a nation, or in certain areas. And so you're having Walmart pulling out, and you're having Walgreens having to come up with a new concept so that the public can't just grab things off the shelf because too many people will take it and run. We can't be trusted to do our own shopping anymore. So I'm kind of reading these headlines, not the Walgreens, but I think, you know, there's been a lot of stories about theft recently. I think we've got a montage that we can play, but you know, we've got all of these different news stories that I'm reading while visiting Germany about people just running into stores, grabbing stuff, leaving, people being arrested, storekeepers, staff in stores being fired when they try to confront robbers, people being arrested by the police because they're trying to confront shoplifters, and it's completely chaotic, completely out of control. And then I kind of show up at this guest house in Germany, this bed and breakfast, and they have a break room with a coffee machine and a fridge. And in the fridge, there's lots of different drinks, you know, non-alcoholic drinks, alcoholic drinks, bottles of wine. And then they just have a price list and a cash box. You know, if you want a beer, it's €3, and you put the euros in the cash box and you take it from the fridge. And the cash box isn't even locked. So if you've got a €10 note and you want a €3 beer, you can put that in the cash box. You can help yourself to the change that you need. And it works fine. No staff needed, and people just, it's an honesty box, and they just go and take care of it themselves. And it wasn't just that we were staying at one kind of guest house in the middle of nowhere where this worked. The next night I was staying in a motel. It was just some fairly cheap motel off the side of a highway. I think this was across the border into Switzerland, but still the same general area. And it's the same system. There's just a fridge and some coffee machines. And if you get in and you want a cup of coffee, you know, you put a few, it's like just a couple of euros or a couple of Swiss francs there. You stick it in the box, you help yourself. If you want a bottle of champagne, they're all in the fridge. It's filled with champagne bottles at the bottom. It's like 20 francs or something like that. You help yourself. I'm like looking at this and reading all these headlines about smashing and grabbing. I mean, you couldn't do that at an American hotel. I mean, these are stores where there's storekeepers and people are still helping themselves. You know, in Britain as well, I mean, would we have the character to have that at a hotel? And then just walking around town in Germany and Switzerland as well, but you're getting all of this footage, all of these headlines out of San Francisco about the place being a complete dump and, you know, being human waste on the streets. I don't know if I saw any litter. I mean, certainly not enough that it kind of registered. You know, walking around some of these towns around Lake Constance and walking around Zurich and Switzerland, they're clean, they're spacious, they're green, they're nicely laid out. There's lots of, I mean, I guess it's not so fun for drivers, but there's lots of pedestrian crossings. It's really safe for pedestrians to walk along. You've often got nice wide roads with a bike path that's kind of separate from the road, so it's easy for people to cycle around and drive around. It seemed like a place would be great to visit with family because it just all looked and felt really safe. and really clean. And then I got the trainer bid while I was there. And again, you look at some of the headlines, you know, so many of the headlines that we've got coming out of the US recently have been about New York subway system. And was it Jordan Neely, this, you know, the guy that's meant to be a talented performer, a Michael Jackson impersonator. Yeah, we can roll the B-roll footage if you've got that. And then somebody pins him down. You're starting to hear all these stories from New York where people are like, well, that's kind of normal. This is what riding the subway is like. It's full of criminals and it's kind of dangerous and a bit scary. And I mean, I don't know. I can't speak from personal experience. I've never ridden the subway in New York, but judging by the news coverage I've seen in the last couple of weeks, I don't think I'd want to. And then you go on the trains in Germany and in Switzerland, and you know, they're clean, neat. No one checked my ticket the entire time. I didn't take a huge number of train journeys, but on the train journeys I took, no one checked my ticket once. There's no ticket machine. It was all on honesty. You pay for your ticket. Now there are ticket inspectors, and there are fines for not displaying it. If they ask to see your ticket and you don't have one, I think there are some quite serious fines for that. I didn't see one this trip. I have seen one in trips before, but they're obviously not super common. You can take a few trips around, not run into any ticket inspectors, because it seems like by and large, people obey the law. They buy their ticket, they go, they get the train. They don't need expensive ticket machines to make sure they've got their tickets. They don't need an army of ticket inspectors coming down all the time. It really feels like you're visiting Germany and one is a rising power and you contrast it with what's coming out of America that's a falling power. I'll get into this a little bit more later, but one of the economic kind of principles that we come back to quite a bit on this show comes from Mr. Armstrong in Autobiography. He talks about this encounter. I think it was Mr. Babster, I think was his name, but this big dinner for businessmen, and this famous economist comes along and he says, well, there's going to be a recession. There's the economy is going to struggle, and everyone laughs at him. And he comes back the next year and he says, well, look, I was right. I told you it was going to struggle. Things were great then, but I said, well, things are going to change. How did I know? Well, I didn't look at, and he uses this example. He said, well, if you want to know what the temperature in a room is going to be, you don't look at the thermometer. You go and you look at the boiler room. That tells you, the thermometer tells you, well, yeah, things are hot in here now or cold in here now. But if you want to know, well, what are they going to be? How are they going to change? You've got to look at cause and effect. And you look at the boiler room. What are the things that we're doing right now? What are they going to cause in the future? And maybe it's hot in here right now, but if the boiler's broken, it's not going to be hot in here in a few hours' time. And it's the same principle. I mean, it's not economics, but you can look at all of these different indicators and you can see, yeah, America's got a lot of power right now. There are a lot of statistics that you can look at for the United States that are very good. What this speaker, and again, I think it was Babster, what he said was, if for the economy, you look at generally morals. Are people treating each other in a moral, upright way? And are they being honest with each other? If they are, well, that means you're going to have prosperity in the future. If they're not, then that means you've got bad economic times coming. And you can say the same about national power. How are people behaving? And you look at these two different countries and you can say, well, there's a whole lot of immorality within Britain and America, and that's going to lead to them going down in power. You go to Germany, there's a lot better behavior. Now, of course, I know I was in a particularly nice part of Germany. There are parts of Germany that are a bit of a dump. There are parts that are not as nice as this. This was kind of a very touristy holiday destination. But then San Francisco used to be a wealthy holiday touristy destination, and you wouldn't really want to visit there today. So, yes, I know that this is not necessarily representative of all of Germany, but I do think you see something there that is in stark contrast to the United States. And there's another story that came out this week that brought this home, where Germany's Christian Democratic Union, they want to make German patriotism great again. They want to create a new national holiday. I think it was May 23rd. It's a day to celebrate. It's the anniversary of Germany's basic law, basically their constitution being introduced. They want to introduce what they're calling a federal program of patriotism to boost national pride in Germany. They want more flag waving. They want more anthem singing. No, we can hold on those for now. They want more ties to the military. So this is, they want the military to be much more public. They want the military to be out in public where people can see them more involved in the national life. And again, stark contrast to the United States. So I was asking producer to hold on some of those pictures because I want to play you instead. This is a picture or a video, again, in the news over the weekend. This was from the U.S. Capitol building. It was a group of school kids. They had permission, etc., to come and sing America's national anthem in Washington, D.C. This is what happened to them. Somebody comes up, you can't sing that here. And there are conflicting reports about what exactly happened. There are quite a few saying, well, they were told, well, that could offend someone. Singing America's national anthem in the capital of America, well, that could offend someone. You can't do that. But if Germany's saying, well, we need to sing our national anthem more. We want to encourage people singing our national anthem. Again, what a turnaround. What a contrast. This is from Deutsche Welle writing about what is happening in Germany. While I'm on, I'll just read this first. It says that the CDU is hoping to wrestle the issue of patriotism from its electoral rivals on the far right, the Alternative for Deutschland. A renewed sense of national pride would counteract the increasing polarization and fragmentation of our society, CDU party leader Friedrich Merz and his CSU floor leader Alexander Dorbint wrote in their proposal. And then this talks about a 2021 poll. It says that 61% of Germans thought schools should foster a more positive connection to Germany among children. What that might mean exactly is unclear, but Germany's history obviously means that patriotism is always going to be deeply problematic. Now, that's from Deutsche Welle saying, well, even we're not super keen, sore necessarily on the history of this. But you've got a major shift within Germany where more people want to have a sense of national pride, and you've got a major political party encouraging them to have more national pride. I guess they're not in government at this point. But still, talking about more flag waving, more anthem singing, more visible military presence and the military taking the lead in parades and things like that. And they're doing this because you've got the Alternative for Deutschland, Germany's... They've become Germany's number two party. And they've been absolutely all about this, trying to bring up and to even change Germany's view of its history and to be much more proud of that history. They want to... their leader recently... He said that it's wrong to always link remembrance with the question of guilt. So, okay, maybe we should just remember the Holocaust, but stop feeling guilty about it. And he said that issues about guilt and blame, well, they should be superseded by the question of the accomplishments of every civilization. And he said historical guilt should no longer determine the way we act. We don't need to think back to... we need to change our view of a lot of this history. We need to not be ashamed of it. And Spiegel had an article, I made this point on Trumpet Hour a few weeks back, where they said, look, another politician from the AfD made these comments a few years ago, and he kind of had to issue a groveling apology or lose his job. Now they're normal. And this is where the CDU is seeing, and they're kind of muscling into this territory that was once viewed as extreme and far right and saying, well, we need to celebrate Germany more. We need to fly the flag more. We need to have more German flags, more German national anthem singing, all the while in the United States, you're having more and more people saying, oh, I don't want to hear the national anthem. You know, there was some liberal, they were in a bar recently, and they tweeted, well, I felt so, they were singing the national anthem. I felt so unsafe. I felt it was so dangerous. And you've got all the taking a knee, the sports movements where they won't sing, people not wanting to fly the flag. Well, if I see an American flag flying, that's racist. And you've got the Celtic Throne tour on right now. And that's one of the things that's really refreshing about that Celtic Throne tour, where there's a bit of a segment in there where there's some patriotic songs. And even as a non-American, it's still refreshing to see people get up there and be proud of their heritage. While America is turning their backs on, where so much of America is just turning their backs on that entirely. I mentioned this alternative for Deutschland going in the opposite direction in Germany, this mainstream party going in the opposite direction. The alternative for Deutschland is now Germany's number two party. This is from a different Deutsche Welle article. It says, never before have voters in Germany been this unhappy with the current coalition government. Only one in five say they are doing a good job. The centre-left Social Democrats, the Greens and the neoliberal Free Democratic Party are plummeting in the polls after only 1.5 years in office. So you've never had a coalition government that's more unpopular in Germany. But they like the sound of the Alternative for Deutschland, and they like the sound of some more of this flag waving. And another contrast here is to see many of these right-wing leaders stand up against pride and this homosexual pride movement. You know, you've got in Italy, Giorgia Meloni, the Italian prime minister, where she's declared June a family pride month, where it's about having pride in Italy's families and parents and father and mother. And then you've got in Germany, they're calling it, I think, Stolzmonat, which is, just translates to Pride Month. And we've put together just a montage of some tweets and things like that that people have put up on social media as part of this hashtag Stolzmonat. And the idea is, okay, we've got, it's Pride Month. Companies are tweeting about Pride Month. Well, we'll tweet about German national pride and about Pride in Germany Month. And we'll flood the hashtags on Twitter with this. So if you click on Pride Month, what you get is a lot of German national pride and just pride in being German rather than this homosexual pride. And so there were all of these memes being posted on Twitter over the weekend, and this was really trending, getting a whole lot of traction. This tweet, I think, explains kind of what this is all about here, where they're kind of putting up these different German flags so that they replace this Stolzmonat with German flags. And so it kind of went viral. It became one of the top trending items on German Twitter as they put up all of these different memes. Not the Bee. They cover kind of stories so crazy that they could be in the Babylon Bee, but they're not. Had a piece on this, and I thought it was, you know, they were like, well, look, I'm all on board with attacking Pride Month, making fun of liberals. This seems great, etc. Not sure how keen I am that this is celebrate German national pride, though, as the alternative. I think that has a few bits of historical baggage, shall we say. So I thought, you know, that was they're right about that. I wonder if this is something we're going to see more and more. You know, in the run-up to World War II, you kind of had communism and Nazism, both deeply and fundamentally evil political movements. You know, evil ideologies. Stalin, number two, biggest mass murderer in history. Adolf Hitler, number three, biggest mass murderer in history. And you had people looking at Hitler and saying, well, at least he's not a communist. He stands up to communism. So, well, I'll support him. I'll side with him, both within Germany and around the world. I wonder if we'll see something similar this time around, where you look at some of these people that we've kind of been saying to watch within Europe, and they do to their credit, stand up to this homosexual lobby and some of the abominations coming out of the United States. And yeah, when Giorgia Meloni says, well, we're making this month Pride in Family Month, and we're going to try and encourage proper traditional families, not all this weirdness that's being foisted on us. Well, yeah, great. You wish we had a British prime minister that did that. I guess it's more thinkable with an American president. Maybe Donald Trump would do something like that. But even he, I think, has kind of caved to a certain extent to the LGBT movement. I could be wrong on that, but I think he did appoint some homosexuals into top positions and things like that. So you maybe we'll see some of these European leaders stand up to this movement. And you already see some in the US doing this. I think the AFD recently, they had some of their leaders meeting with Ron DeSantis. And I think Tucker Carlson has praised Giorgia Meloni and Viktor Orban. Are we going to see a lot of people cheering what's going on in Europe because they're anti-woke? And I think you could see that. And like I said, when talking about America, I think it is kind of refreshing to see countries proud in their own power. And so now you see Germany saying, well, we're standing up to the woke movement and we're doing that with German pride and being proud of German nationalism. And so there are people in the United States and commentators in the United States that are looking at that and saying, well, excellent, we'll support you on that. That's fantastic. Yes, you know, be proud of this German nationalism. We need more of this German nationalism. And you can understand that view. And I have a lot of sympathy for Germans wanting to be proud of their country. I think one of my favorite articles that we've had on The Trumpet on Germany has been one that I think Mr. Malone wrote it years and years ago. It was called something along the lines of A Nation Worth Applauding, that just talks about a lot of the positive history from Germany. So yes, it is there, and there are strengths that God is going to use powerfully. We've got some wonderful prophecies about the world tomorrow, when God says he's going to use Germany in a really positive way. But some of the best warnings about the return of German nationalism kind of comes from Germans themselves. There's a lot of German historians that have warned about these kind of movements and said, well, no, we need to remain anchored in history, and we need to remain anchored in the right view of history. I think it's just been amazing over the last 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, to the credit of German historians, at least there was a generation of German historians, they're mostly dead now, who were much more clear-eyed on German history than British or American historians were. And you'd have all of these British-American historians, kind of, and I think Christopher Clarke is one of them, he's Australian, I believe, who were coming out and saying, you know, kind of Germans were the victims, they were unfairly blamed for World War I, and then World War I and this unfair blame kind of led directly into World War II. And this was all not really Germany's fault. And Germany is just kind of a victim of history. And the biggest people pushing back against that have been German historians themselves. People like Fritz Fischer, who wrote just a pretty hefty volume proving beyond any shred of doubt that Germany was responsible for World War I. It's just, he was incredibly thorough and meticulous about doing this. And I think he was attacked in Germany. His car was firebombed. But he was like, look, we've got to get this right. We've got to understand our history. And we've got to understand we weren't just a victim in the 20th century. We have a repeated pattern of starting world wars and invading countries. And if we're going to not victimize Europe again, we need to learn from that. Another one of those historians was Immanuel Geis. I think he died maybe 10 years ago or so. And you know, he said that Germany must forget about all patriotic dreams of a German Reich. He said that otherwise it would inevitably lead to a third phase of German power politics, hence leading to a third world war initiated once again by Germany. And Geis was more recent than Fritz Fischer, and he really fought hard against a lot of this revisionism that was trying to say, well, Germany, you know, they're not really to blame for World War I, and not really, you know, it's just kind of been a bit of a tragedy. He fought hard against that. But he himself warned against the patriotic dreams of a German Reich. And what are we seeing in Europe now? Well, you're seeing more and more patriotic dreams of a German Reich. You know, you're seeing this. I've never seen patriotic dreams of a German Reich trending on Twitter. And that's what you've got, and all of these flags with symbols from the German Reich. And you've got the Germany's most popular political party, the conservative, the Christian Union parties. And then you've got the second top party, the Alternative for Deutschland, saying, well, we need more German flags and music and military parades. And we need to get back to this history. This matches a broader trend throughout Europe. You know, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury had an article a few years ago, The Holy Roman Empire Goes Public Big Time, where he was talking about just the revival of the history of the Holy Roman Empire, how these symbols were being put on display more and more. You were having people come out and saying, well, we need a European Union that's more like the Holy Roman Empire. And he wrote in that article, you cannot truly understand the Holy Roman Empire unless you understand history and the Bible. Most are blinded and lack true understanding on both these vital sources. Having a good grasp of the Holy Roman Empire and what is happening in Europe today is vital if you are going to be prepared for what is coming in the future. He also said Europeans are doing something they have never done since World War II, basically. He said they are publicizing the Holy Roman Empire. They don't publicize what Adolf Hitler did. Too many people remember that bloody history. Instead, they cloak it in the tradition of Charlemagne, and yet it is the same story. Not as many people died in the First Reich because they didn't have the same military technology then, but it's the same ambition. So you're seeing this revival and pride in German history at the same time he talks about in that article. You're seeing a revival for a desire for a strong man. And this is a prophecy that Herbert W. Armstrong made for years and years and years. And it's sad because you have his church, so many that once followed him, turned away. And yet we're seeing so much of what he said being fulfilled just in detail. And sure, it's taken a little bit longer than he thought it would. But you look at what he was saying you would see happen. And he said, well, you're going to have a sort of European Union. And it's going to rise in Europe. And it's going to begin as an economic power. And it's going to become a political power. And it's going to be led by Germany. And it's going to be he was writing this, and this European power was coming together, and it was getting bigger and drawing in more countries. And he was saying, well, it's going to have 10 nations. At one point, it did have 10 nations, but he was very specific. He said, it's not going to be the 10 that are in there right now. It's going to be 5 from the east and 5 from the west. And so it's going to shrink down. And it's going to take a crisis to get this all to come together. And there's going to be a strong leader. And then Mr. Armstrong died, and Mr. Fleury picked up the baton, and he was writing. You look at some of the very first issues of the Trumpet magazine, and they're being written in 1990, 1991, 1992. Germany is just reunited. The Berlin Wall has fallen. You're starting to get Germany being one country that we've not had before, and German patriotism is reviving. And he's saying, well, watch this trend. And now we're seeing Germany's top political party. We need more flags and we need more bands and we need to sing the national anthem more. And we're seeing Germany rising before our eyes. It's a massive fulfillment of Bible prophecy. And we've got that book, He Was Right, on the screen there. That's a great place to go and learn about what Mr. Armstrong was talking about. You can read that, or you can order that on that phone number we've got up on the screen there, 1-866-930-3024. You can also get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. Well, we'll take a quick break. We'll be back, I think, with just a brief bit of economic news before we get into a bit of a Bible study today. Be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong described Germany's devastating destruction in 1944 and 1945 as one of the worst beatings ever administered to any nation. Western leaders from both sides of the Atlantic assured our peoples that a demoralized Germany would never again be able to disturb the peace of the world. But while Washington and London were promising that German militarism would never again be able to strike, Herbert Armstrong was warning the world of one final resurrection of a German-led Holy Roman Empire. Only a very few listened. Mr. Armstrong said German industry and the German people's willpower and determination to work, produce, and organize was the very heart and lifeblood of all Europe.
The nations of Europe want to unite. They just don't know how to do it.
He said the prostrate body of Europe could not come back without the leadership of a revived and vigorous Germany.
And the economic and the military body that is to rise up and to restore the Roman Empire, the thing that we least suspect here in the United States, it cannot rise up without its heart. And its heart is in Germany.
The world is witnessing history repeat itself one more time. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire for more on this important subject. The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily show. I just wanted to talk very briefly about a story I'm kind of amazed hasn't gotten more traction both here in the UK and in the US. And that is this story about the rigging of the LIBOR rates. This is something you might remember. A story came out about this in 2012, about 10 years ago. And, you know, so many of these stories, you don't hear the truth of the story until many, many years later. So if you think back in 2012, you had the LIBOR scandal. So one of the most important economic indicators is what interest rates banks are charging when they lend money to other banks. Gives you an overview of how healthy the economy is, but then it's used to set all these other things. We wrote about it at the time. Here's what we wrote. It was in an article, The Death of Anglo-American Banking. It said, there's a single number at the heart and core of the world's financial system. This number sets the interest rates on a whopping $800 trillion of financial products, including your car loan, your adjustable rate mortgage, the student loans you are still paying off, your credit card, any personal loans you have, and even your savings account at the bank. And even though you probably don't deal with hundreds of trillions of worth of complex financial instruments like swaps and futures, they too are linked to this number and they affect you. The number is called LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate. So this was the rate, and it's basically based on honesty. It's kind of like the little break rooms in the German hotels. It relies on bankers honestly saying, well, this is how, yeah, we made a whole range of loans over the last week. This is a good average for the interest rate that we charged on those loans. And what we found out is banks were lying about it. We wrote at the time, if all the allegations prove true, this is by far the biggest financial scandal the world has ever seen. The whole Anglo-American financial system from head to toe is sick, and that's an understatement. And what we found out over the last couple of weeks is, no, the allegations weren't true. It was a lot worse than we realized. So what was going on, what we knew was going on was bankers were lying about these to help their friends and to help. There were all kinds of kickbacks, things like that going around, where, you know, somebody would be on the trading floor, they would make an investment, and potentially they would make a huge amount of money if LIBOR went up. Or they would make a huge amount of money if LIBOR went down, or maybe they'd lose money if it went down, or something like that. And so they'd pick up the phone to their colleague who is in charge of reporting the LIBOR rate and say, hey, can you send in some low numbers? Because, okay, the LIBOR rate is averaged across a whole range of banks, but if their bank sends in a very low number, it could pull the average down. They could make a huge amount of money. And you've got, I think these are from some of the things that were put in court. So one person wrote, dude, I owe you big time. Come over one day after work. I'm opening a bottle of Bollinger. You know, great, I owe you. Let's have some champagne together. Because there are all kinds of kickbacks and things like this going on. People being paid to or bribed, basically, to lie about the interest rate. And this article that we wrote, The Death of Anglo-American Banking, just talked about the consequences of this. If you have a situation where just the financial system is saturated in lies,
The article quoted Jeremy Warner at the Daily Telegraph, who does a lot, writes a lot on British finance. He wrote, "In all my years as a financial journalist, it's hard to recall a case as shameful as LIBOR. And I've certainly seen a few. We wrote, it's as if people check their moral coats at the door when they become global bankers." The article says, compared to this, Bernie Madoff is a carnival slideshow. Bank of England Deputy Governor Paul Tucker says his investigation has revealed a rotten system. He says that beyond LIBOR, other indices and markets need to be investigated too. I can't be confident about anything after learning about this cesspit, he says. And we talked about, well, what are the consequences for Britain and America's financial system if nobody can trust it and it's all based on lies? Well, what we found out over the last couple of weeks, somebody did an investigation, published a new book. It wasn't just bankers lying to make a quick buck. It was governments. It was people at the Fed, people at the Bank of England. They were pacing phones to banks and saying, hey, you need to change what LIBOR rate you're indicating. It's reflecting poorly on us as a government. It's impacting us. A lot of this was happening in the wake of the 2008 financial crisis. Governments wanted their banks to look stronger than they actually were. So they wanted to be able to say, well, look, our economy is healthy. All these banks are lending to each other at low interest rates. They're confident that they're going to get that money back. So don't worry about the financial system. It's all good. We're all fine. And to do that, they were lying and putting pressure on all of these bankers. The British government, you know, they had a bailout package, for example. I think they'd approved $50 billion to bail out banks. But they were telling these bankers, basically, if you want your bailout money, you've got to lie about LIBOR. We will not. And for some of these banks, it wasn't until they lied about LIBOR that they got their cash from the government. So the government isn't bailing out banks is bad enough, but they're using that bailout money to go bribe the banks to do whatever they like. And then the FBI comes into the story. So a few years later, the FBI starts investigating because this is all completely illegal. You had, I think, about half a dozen people go to jail over the LIBOR riggings. So they're coming along. They're interviewing people. They interview, I think, somebody at the Bank of England or Barclays Bank. They give them all the evidence they need on a silver platter. This is from the Times write-up. It says, before the interview wrapped up at 7:30 p.m., Johnson had given the U.S. investigators names, dates, and figures. In his view, all they needed to investigate, expose, and prosecute what had every appearance of an unprecedented financial scandal. It involved top bank bosses, central banks, and governments across the Western world, pressuring him and others, in some cases against their protest, to change their LIBOR submissions in a way that violated the BBA definition. To lie, basically. To serve the commercial interests of the banks, the very same actions for which traders would later be jailed. He had pointed the US authorities to the Bank of England, the Bank of France, and the Fed, supplying all the evidence and investigative leads the FBI, CFTC, SEC, and DOJ could have wished for to set about proving that. However, just like the tape of the instructions he received from Dearlove, this is from someone else, Johnson's interview with the FBI and regulators was not produced in public. The important information it contained was not made available for the scrutiny of Parliament, the press, or the public, nor for juries in rate rigging in London that would result in traders being sent to prison. It was all covered up. So you have people at the top of Britain's banks, America's banks, all there's a financial crisis and they respond by lying and cheating. The FBI investigates because they're breaking the law. They completely cover it up. By this time, we're well into the Obama FBI, which means then the Obama FBI has information on all of America's on a lot of America's top finance officials that could send them to jail. They choose not to publish that. What else are they doing with that information, though? And if these bankers are lying and cheating about this, and America's kind of, and Britain's top financial authorities are lying and cheating and breaking the law here, what other laws are they lying and cheating and breaking? What other laws do the FBI have access to? But what this story really has in common with what we talked about in the first half is the consequences of lawlessness. and of getting away from, in this case, it's just man's law, but getting away from the law. And this is common now. It's all elements of society, whether it's people running in and robbing Walgreens or people at the top of the Federal Reserve pushing American banks to break the law and to lie about different financial instruments. And, okay, well, we can't, you could not get away with setting up an honesty box now in American hotels, and you can't get away with allowing American banks just to honestly report what money they're putting in and they're putting out. And even the very idea of law being a good thing is under attack. This is a clip from a graduation ceremony at a City University of New York commencement address. Just a short clip here.
To recognize that the law is a manifestation of white supremacy that continues to oppress and suppress people in this nation and around the world. We join this institution.
So it's just a pause for applause at the end there. And the applause goes on for a bit because she said, well, the law is racist. Lawless, if the law is racist, well, then surely the right thing to do to be anti-racist is to be lawless. That seems like what she's saying. And I think this is what's on display with that LIBOR scandal. I thought this was what was on display visiting Germany and contrasting what I was seeing in Germany with what I was seeing from the news coming out of the United States, or visiting just about any big city in Britain as well. The consequences of lawlessness. If you want a nice city, if you want the convenience of being able to have a break room in your, I mean, I'm going on about this like it's something big and amazing. And I mean, it was interesting. I'm not sure if I even used the break rooms in either place because I didn't have any Swiss francs on me and didn't feel like grabbing anything from the German one. But if you want that convenience, if you want that price, things are a lot cheaper than if you have to go to some, kind of like a store in an American hotel because they don't have to pay a staff member to sit there the whole time. If you want a railway system that's nice and clean and, again, cheaper because you don't have to pay for all of these security measures, well, obey the law. If you want cities where you can visit with your family and feel safe and not be robbed or put at gunpoint or anything like that, well, obey the law. There's just a common cause and effect. And you have a lot of people obeying, or more people at least, or more of a respect for law, I think, in Germany than you do in Britain and the United States. And there's a result for that. There's a consequence of that. And so we've got a few minutes to have a little bit of a Bible study. It is worth talking about law at this time of year. Let's look at Exodus chapter 19. You know, it's just a very simple law of cause and effect. And you don't get too many people in the Christian world talking about law because there's a lot of deception. There's a lot of deception on this subject of law. There's a real spirit world with Satan the devil, who's a being full of lawlessness, who fundamentally hates God's law and rebels against it. But really, we need law, and there are wonderful things that come from it. You know, the law of the United States or the law of Germany right now, they're not God's law, no. And there are plenty of things in there that are wrong in both countries and immoral. But things like don't steal, you know, there are things enshrined in law that do come right out of God's law. And as far as a nation kind of adheres to those principles and adheres to even just the principle of rule of law, well, there are positive consequences that come from that. But if we look in Exodus chapter 19, and this is the setting for God giving his law, it says, in the third month when the children of Israel were gone forth out of the land of Egypt, the same day came they into the wilderness of Sinai. So this is in the third month of the Hebrew year. They come, or the third month after leaving Egypt, they come into this area and God gives them the law. Well, this is the month in which Pentecost falls, this holy day that took place, I guess we're getting on for a couple of weeks now. A Bible correspondence course says, according to Jewish tradition, God spoke his law from Mount Sinai on the day of Pentecost, Careful study of the route and time Israel took to get to Mount Sinai after leaving Egypt shows that this tradition is almost certainly correct. The Jews never lost this history. And so, and this is something God wants us to remember. He worked hard to make the giving of his law just this epic, dramatic moment. This was, you know, God was giving his law to Israel, and it was a key pivotal moment in human history. He was giving a nation everything that they needed to be happy and prosperous. And so he worked hard to give this day of Pentecost when he gave out this law a real drama. And you can read that in Exodus chapter 19. I'll just maybe hit just a couple of highlights. If we look in verse 16, it says, "It came to pass on the third day in the morning that there were thunders and lightnings and a thick cloud upon the mount and the voice of the trumpet exceeding loud so that all the people that was in the camp trembled. And Moses brought forth the people out of the camp to meet with God, and they stood at the nether part of the mount. And Mount Sinai was altogether on a smoke, because the Eternal descended upon it as in fire, and the smoke thereof ascended as the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked greatly." You know, earthquakes and fire and thunder and lightning. Mr. Gerald Flurry, in his book, The Way of Peace Restored Momentarily, he writes, "This was an awfully important day. What a setting to receive the law of God. What a spectacular introduction to that law. How important is it to God?" And he goes and describes this, this spectacle in more detail. And he writes, "With this spectacle, God gave his law that produces peace, the very law he wanted all mankind to live by on that day of Pentecost. Millennia later, in Pentecost of AD 31, he gave the Holy Spirit so we could keep that law spiritually. God also founded the New Testament church, his spiritual nation, that day. God wants us to remember this history at Mount Sinai. All that Pentecost history is part of the same picture, going right back to God giving his law. If we don't recognize this, we are going to miss a lot." You know, God gave this on the Feast of Pentecost, and so much of the solution to this world's problems revolves around teaching the law. And like I said, I think you look at some of the headlines, like, say, the LIBOR rigging, and you look at this contrast of said visiting Germany versus visiting Canada or the United States, and you see the power of the law to solve our problems on display. You keep the law and you get better results, and the better you keep it, the better results that you're going to get. In this booklet, Mr. Flurry wrote, "Teaching the law is a crucial job for God's people. Certainly, we teach God's law of love and peace with words, but even more importantly, we teach by our example, by being doers of the word. We are committed to showing the world how to keep God's law of peace. And we set a demonstration of it." That's what the Celtic throne performance is all about in many ways, demonstrating that law of peace in action. And there's bits in there where you kind of, there's maybe some discordant music, and it shows the consequences of disobedience to that law, even musically, and then you get a wonderful finale where you have that law going out over the universe, really. But going back to that article, we're giving away millions of dollars worth of literature. We show people how to bring peace and joy into their marriages and families, how to make their spiritual lives successful. We give through our cultural foundation. We invite this world into Armstrong Auditorium and strive to give them the most positive, uplifting, and royal experience we possibly can. This is the solution to the world's problems. This is the solution. This is how we bring good things and positive things into our life as well. We work to keep that law, and we get a message out to the world about where they're sinning. We show God, the world, their sins, where they're breaking the law, and we get ready to teach them how to obey that law in the future. It all revolves around God's wonderful royal law. Well, that's about all that we have time for, talking about many of the problems and the solution to a lot of what we see in this world. I believe Mr. Stephen Flurry will be right back with you tomorrow, giving you an update, I'm sure, on his very exciting trip You can get in touch with us. Be very happy to see you at or hear from you, emailing us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Feel free to give us a call as well on 1-866-930-3024.